Good evening and welcome to the August 2018 meeting of the County of San Luis Obispo Health Commission. Our first order of business this evening will be to approve the minutes of our last two meetings, actually. The first being the June 11th, 2018 meeting, and the second being July 2018, which was our planning retreat. So are there any additions or corrections to the June minutes? Seeing none, hearing none, we'll ask Jean to publish them as she always does. How about the July 9th meeting? Any additions or corrections to that? Okay, and I assume you all got the additional attachments to the meeting because we discussed a lot of things. Good. Since there are no additions or corrections to that, we'll...
There is
one. Oh, there is. Jean has one.
Just the place where the Adult Services Policy Council meets.
It is no longer at Caps Low. It's at the Vets Hall.
Oh, on the liaison list?
Yes, on the liaison list.
Okay, anything else? They'll be approved then as noted. I have one other question about that liaison list, Jean. Do you notify each of those committees so that our respective members will be on the mailing list for when they send out the meeting notices and that? Or do we each need to connect?
I'll email them.
Okay, thank you. All right, this is the time when we invite public comment. If there's anybody in our audience that would like to comment on something other than what we have on our scheduled agenda. Seeing no one coming forward, I think we'll go right into our presentation for the evening. So tonight we're going to talk about human trafficking, and we are delighted to have with us Beth Robb, who is has been here before, actually. Welcome back. She is with the Victim Witness Program for our county out of the County District Attorney's Office, and she's brought with her this evening Rebecca Turner from Central Coast Freedom Network, which will also be presenting. So ladies, welcome. It's yours.
Thank you for inviting us to speak here tonight on this very important subject. Tonight we'll be talking about human trafficking, kind of a definition, red flags. Feel free to ask questions just as we move through our presentation. To start out, my name is Beth Robb, like Mary Jean said, and currently I am Assistant Director at the Victim Witness Assistance Center, which works in the District Attorney's Office. I also sit on the Human Trafficking Task Force that the DA chairs, and then we have multiple community members and resources that come in around human trafficking that forms the task force, from law enforcement, medical community, nonprofits, and me and Rebecca co-chair the Education and Outreach Committee for that task force. And I'll let Rebecca introduce herself.
Hi, thank you so much for having us this evening. My name is Rebecca Turner. I'm the co-founder and executive director of the Central Coast Freedom Network. We are a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to countering human trafficking on the Central Coast. And right now, our two umbrellas are community education and developing services for survivors of human trafficking. So currently, we provide case management, and we're working on training advocates to be able to respond in crisis situations.
Very good. Okay, and so we have a PowerPoint tonight. Hopefully it'll come up on the screen here. There we go. There we go. And we're going to start with a definition.
Perfect. So human trafficking, very simplified, is essentially a form of modern-day slavery in which people profit from the control and exploitation of others. Everything kind of boils down to control and power. And it's defined under U.S. law. Victims of human trafficking include children involved in the sex trade, adults age 18 or over who have been coerced or deceived into the commercial sex acts, and then anyone forced into different forms of labor or services. This could be domestic workers held in a home or farm workers forced to labor against their will. And the next slide. will show us different types of labor and sex trafficking. This is really just a snapshot. One of the leading experts in the fight against human trafficking is actually Polaris Project, and they have identified 25 industries in the U.S. where there's a prevalence of human trafficking. 24 of those industries are actually on the Central Coast. So that is an extrapolation. This is a new movement, so it's very hard to collect data and to offer a clear view on what is happening. In our community, I can speak to the fact that we are farther ahead in identifying sex trafficking. That's because there are more resources put towards sex trafficking. So all of those on the right-hand column, we have had instances, there is a local prevalence of brothels posing as massage parlors, and we have had collected narratives regarding gang-related prostitution, gang-related sex trafficking. And then online, there is definitely a prevalence of people being sold online. And the 101 is essentially a way that traffickers will move women, children, men through the Central Coast and sell them for sex. And you can see their pictures or phone numbers moving from like LA, Orange County area through the Central Coast up to the Bay Area and over to Vegas, again, is one of the more common routes. Mm-hmm. And then labor trafficking, we're a little farther ahead in identifying, but at least with my work with the Central Coast Freedom Network, we can definitely say that it is happening in the agriculture locally. And in the wine industry, definitely. Beth, did you want to comment on any of those?
For myself, too, a lot of it crosses over with domestic violence and in sex trafficking as well. However, I've seen examples of what I would call forced begging. I had a volunteer from when I used to work at Stand Strong. And I had a volunteer there that came up to me and said, I just saw this and I don't know what it is. And she had seen a woman begging outside of Food for Less when she'd left the store. And she said when she walked past her, the woman kept looking back over her shoulder at a car that a man was sitting in. And so she came to me and she said, I don't know what to do. I know something's wrong. Just all of her little alerts went off. And I said, that was probably forced begging. It was either domestic violence or she was probably being trafficked and forced to beg at that point. And so she did the right thing. She called law enforcement. When they got there, law enforcement, the person was gone. So it was a matter of she saw it, she felt those feelings when you know there's something wrong, and then she did try to report it and put out a description and everything. So, I mean, that's an example of something we've seen right here outside our own grocery store. So it can appear in many different ways, and we're going to talk about some red flags to help identify that. There we go. Okay. So before we talk about this, I want to talk about a local case. Briefly, about 2010, we had a case here on the Central Coast called the Morales. They owned a residential units that took care of elder and disabled folks up in the Paso Robles area. They had four homes up there. And they were working with a co-conspirator in the Philippines. And what they would do is this person in the Philippines would tell people, hey, do you want to go to America? We've got a great job for you over there. We can help you get over there. And they would have people come over. They'd get their paperwork. They'd falsify it. They'd come over, and they'd come to this job, and it was not what it was promised to be. They were forced to work in facilities that they were paid less than minimum wage, and they were told they had to pay off a debt. So when they got here, they were told, you have to pay us for your travel, you have to pay us for your paperwork, you have to pay off your debt to the traffickers. They are forced to sleep on sofas, in closets, in just walled-off sections of an unheated garage. And they were kept in line with threats to call the police, call immigration, threats to get them in trouble. They didn't speak the language when they first got here. And then you're under this kind of power and control of these people control the money, you don't know the laws, and they're in this situation that they didn't think they're going to be in. So the victims in this case, actually how this came to light, was a person was coming in and visiting her loved one. And she just, again, got that feeling, there's something wrong here. This doesn't look right to me. And she befriended one of the workers. And it took a little while, but the worker opened up to her, and then she reported the situation. And it went on into investigation, and they were charged. And in 2012, the two traffickers, the Moraleses, pled to 18 months in state prison. So they were sentenced in 2012 to 18 months in state prison, and they were ordered to pay $600,000 in restitution to nine of the Filipino victims that were not properly paid during that time. So for that story, there's certain things in trafficking that have to be proven to charge them. So we see a lot of trafficking, but it's hard to come up with these things that you have to prove in order to file a case, in order to prosecute somebody. And those three elements are: first is the process. You have to prove, were they recruited? Was there harboring? Did they move people? How was this person obtained, right? The second is there has to be you have to prove force, fraud, or coercion of this person, of this victim. Then three, for what purpose? You have to prove an end. Like, what was the purpose of this? So you have to prove, was it involuntary servitude, debt bondage, or slavery? So now here's where I'm going to ask you. In the story I just told you about the story of the Moraleses from the Philippines, what are some of the examples for the first part there, for the process? What did they do to prove that? They recruited them in the Philippines. They had the co-conspirator, right? And what else did they do in that first part there? Yep, they harbored them in the residential area. Okay, for the second part, what in that story kind of showed or proved that second part, the means? Fraud and coercion, right. Right, they got them false papers. They coerced them into it. And then they, by force, they threatened them. Right? So all those. And then the end, what was the end? What was their purpose? Yep. And debt bondage, both of those. And you can see how it's not really one, right? These all kind of mix together. Now, I will say here that for children, that number two goes away. All you have to prove is they recruited them somehow and they have a purpose for them. You don't have to prove that the child was coerced or forced or frauded in some way. So, and that's right here on the Central Coast that we have that happening. And so here we're going to jump into some red flags. Like, I've given two stories now where somebody thought something was wrong, right? So what are we looking for when we talk about trafficking? All of us in the, and especially in the health industry, right, you observe body language. You observe interactions between people. So that's huge. Does this person seem afraid? Do they seem like they're in control of their own possessions? Do you have any other?
Yeah. All of those on the screen are accurate red flags. And I would just like to point out the second and third ones. As an advocate, kind of in a mentor position, I've attended, I have accompanied several survivors to the hospital. One in particular had a high-risk pregnancy, so we were there quite often. And only about half the time would the staff actually separate us, which I found as kind of a red flag because they don't know who I am, and I was there with, good intent, but it just poses that anybody could be a trafficker. So that's something I would love to see in the future.
Mm-hmm. And I actually, Central Coast Freedom Network puts on a fantastic summit that happens in January every other-ish year. It's called the Justice Summit. It'll come up again in 2019. I totally recommend it for anybody who wants to attend. The last one I went to, I actually met a doctor who came to the summit because she had a couple come into her office. She worked at one of those med stop type places, and she knew something was wrong, but she didn't know what to do about it, right? She was like, what would be the trafficker was answering all the questions for the victim. Victim was not allowed to speak. she could tell that this was a power and control situation. Was it domestic violence? Was it trafficking? We don't know, but something was wrong. So one of the things that I told her about was definitely separating them. You can use HIPAA laws. You can say it's part of our policy, whatever it is, to get them separated so you can be alone with that victim for just a little bit of time to assess the situation, see what safety issues are going on. So a lot of it is just using your own kind of information and putting more than one of these together. And we have another slide, I think, of even more red flags. Maybe it's down the way a little bit.
Yeah, next one.
There it is. Even more red flags. We'll come back to kids in a minute. But when you see one red flag, that could just be, what's going on here, right? If you see multiple red flags, that's something to really pay attention to. You know, if you have somebody coming in who seems scared, who seems nervous, and then they have, the third one down there, evidence of prior poor attempt to treat. Maybe they have wounds or something that needed medical attention that you can tell did not get medical attention. That could be a red flag that you can add with the other one. So kind of putting those pieces together. Do you have something from this slide?
The evidence of prior poor attempt to treat, and specifically in sex trafficking, or even in labor cases where they are also being sexually abused, repeated abortions and miscarriages would be common, and it takes time out of a trafficker's day. They face lost income if they take time out to seek medical attention for a victim. So those are definitely red flags, I would say, for sex trafficking. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's jump back to kids here real quick. You want to go ahead on this one?
Just substance abuse being one of the things, drugs being one of the tools traffickers use to keep children and adults connected to them. There is obviously a lot of psychological trauma and brainwashing that occurs, but substance abuse occurs in most cases where they force a child or an adult to take something and get them addicted to it. So that would be one of the biggest red flags I'd like to highlight on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then anything else on this slide? I think also the injury doesn't match history. I think I worded that funny. But basically what we're talking about there is when somebody comes in and is describing how they got an injury, and you can tell probably not how they got that injury, that could be a red flag also. Like, you know, that's fingerprints. It's not a cupboard door that hit them, right? So it's kind of putting that together. And from that point, it's really about creating kind of a non-judgmental space so that they can open up, right? And tell you what's going on. Here's more physical red flags that somebody in the medical community may see.
And then there on the bottom, branding, tattooing, to show ownership is probably one of the biggest red flags. So asking someone in a trauma-informed way maybe what their tattoo means to them or something like that to gather a little bit more information. Tattooing is something that traffickers will use to show ownership over a victim.
Mm-hmm. And then any kind of weight loss or just other complications. That's okay. I was terrified that was going to happen to me. So thanks for taking care of that. This is a repeat. Sorry, I didn't get a slide out of there. There we go. Now we're at safety considerations. Okay, so.
Yeah, so we might leave you with more questions than answers. These are some things that I'm sure, you know, depending on the hospital or agency, maybe the policies and procedures differ. But these are just some questions that we have all healthcare professionals ask. What they would do if they suspect that the trafficker is present, whether that's an admission by the survivor or if it's something that they've just intuited. And then this one is really huge from like the advocate perspective, what could happen if the patient does not return to the trafficker? So just highlighting the importance of creating a safe, non-judgmental space is the most important. Everybody gets excited about rescue or intervention, but just knowing that this patient, this person is the expert in their situation and they know the cost of going back and returning or of escaping, and they're the only ones that can really evaluate that cost. Especially with trafficking and in labor cases, it might be organized crime. They might have family and friends back that are also at risk. So safety planning being the ultimate goal in this situation. And then are staff in any danger? Those are just some questions to consider.
Mm-hmm. And certainly if when I just want to highlight, if you're part of the medical community, like Dignity Health or something like that, finding out what the policies are in your building, like in your zone, how do you chart it? Who do you talk to? Who do you tell? And how do you report this to somebody if you need to? That sort of thing. And also when somebody does disclose, where do you go from there? Who do you safety plan with? And we're going to give you a resource for that as well. Because the safety planning, I always tell people, especially when I was working in domestic violence, it's really about your planting seeds, right? If we're going to do prevention, if we're going to give them their power back and what's safety for them, you're planting a seed. So they may not go, yes, I'm ready to go right now, but you can plant a seed. So then maybe in 2 or 3 months, they are ready to go. Or they're ready to do something. So it's all about giving their power back, but we still have to stop the trafficker. There's this criminal element that everybody has to come to grips with when they touch human trafficking or when human trafficking touches them. Okay, so survivors may experience a lot of different things when they are going through human trafficking, when they're leaving human trafficking, and people do. Get out. And so one of them I'd like to point out is G, non-identification as a victim. And this can be very hard to understand looking from the outside in. But if somebody jumps in and says, well, you're a victim of this, they may not be there yet. They may be, I'm this person's girlfriend. You don't understand what's going on. So it's important to let them self-identify and maybe not tag them early with something until they're ready for it, because they may not be there yet. Then also, they may have a lack of empowerment to heal. If you've had your power taken away and stripped away, you may not think that you're worth it. You may not think that you can heal, that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I'll
let you expand. Yes, and then F, lack of knowledge regarding victims' rights. I think that this is a huge one. So one thing in establishing that safe place, and one thing that all staff could have is brochures, educating people on their rights and resources. That might be that would be a huge resource.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's the national resource. This is Polaris Project. They're a 24-hour crisis line, and you can also text them. This is for victims, advocates, any community member. If you see something, you're like, oh, I don't know, maybe. You can also call them and just kind of run the situation by them and see if there's enough to report or if there's anything they should. How it kind of works is they take the information and then they have a connection in the district attorney's office that if there's a case here locally, they would pass it to that contact. And then it goes from there, just depending on what the case is and what should happen, if there's enough to move forward. Anything else about Polaris?
Polaris is the one that I said did the study and identified 25 different types of human trafficking in the U.S. They have a report on their website that's called The Typology of Human Trafficking, and it goes through, and it's the closest to real data that we have in the U.S. at the moment. So they kind of delineate per type of trafficking who the offenders are, who the traffickers are likely to be. There's a victimology report, and then possibly what visas are being exploited, and it kind of is a wonderful resource for further education if you're interested.
Mm-hmm. And T visas are very much like U visas. Have you heard of those where somebody, is brought over here, let's say trafficking, they're brought over here, and then abuse happens, and they get out of the trafficking situation, they can apply for a T visa, which can give them the opportunity to work and stay here in the United States. And so that's immigration lawyers that they have to deal with, but we certify them at the district attorney's level. And it's really good because they control their immigration paperwork, which is something that maybe the trafficker was controlling before, and this gives them that power back that they can control it themselves and get updated on it and go through the process. If somebody has been trafficked, I can't remember how many they give away each year, but it's definitely not as utilized as U visas, which tend to be more towards sexual assault or domestic violence. So, but it is a good resource for people. So, Polaris Project, so this is a good number to put in your phone under human trafficking. If you put it under Polaris or anything like that, you'll forget what it is. But if you put it under human trafficking, if you come up with something, you can certainly give them a call. I love getting my nails done. And so one of the things that I do now is I walk into a nail parlor and I kind of look around, and legally different businesses, one of them being a nail parlor or salon, has to put up a human trafficking poster that talks about human trafficking. It has this number on it, and it says, you know, if you see it, you can report it, or if you're a victim, here's where you get resources. So I always kind of scan around, and do I see it, and where are these people? And I always kind of talk to them and see where they're living just to kind of, you know, feel it out. And I'm happy to say, so far, so good. I haven't had to report anybody. So far, I'm doing very well. But it's always just good to keep in your mind of just when you're walking through your life, because that's how these things, that's how victims get helped, is if the community is aware.
So where do you usually see it? In the salon, Beth?
You mean the poster? It needs to be in like a community visible area. So I don't know if I can say the name of the business on air here, but they had it like actually right by the front desk posted. And then the other thing I always watch for is I pay the tip in cash, and then I hang out and mess with my purse to make sure the person I gave the cash to gives it to the person who did my nails. And so that's always a good sign if they get their tip, because a trafficker is going to keep the tip, right? So it's all those little things you kind of start to learn when you're doing things like
that. Well, I've noticed over the last few years, actually, now that we're on nail salons, that many of them have signs that say tips have to be in. You can use your charge card for the service, but tips have to be in cash.
Oh,
that's a good, you know, I hadn't thought about watching that, but that's a good point.
Yeah, where does that tip go afterwards? It's a good signal. That's good. So, okay. And so then for presentations or our information, so if we get done, you have any questions, you can certainly contact myself or you can contact Rebecca. I also brought human trafficking task force brochures in English and in Spanish. I will leave them here with Jean. And if you'd like some just good information to give to people, it has the different resources that we have here locally, and this is built on our local task force that we have, and so it has like our mission and why we're concerned in this area on there too. So, and with that, any wrap up? No. Okay.
Questions.
So, yeah, any questions you have or anything you'd like to revisit? That was kind of our presentation there.
Well, I'm sure we'll have questions. So, why don't we start to my right, Commissioner Campbell?
Well, I was sort of prepared for this, but it's still just so sobering.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say a little bit about your impressions of the prevalence of the different varieties of trafficking in the county?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would be happy to address that. Again, it is new, so I don't have data for you. But being on the ground and connected to a lot of grassroots organizations and then word of mouth from current survivors we've helped, I think there's a high prevalence locally, with massage parlors or brothels posing as massage parlors. I had a colleague do some open web research like 3 years ago, and she found online ads for sex linked to local addresses for massage parlors. And in Slo County alone, there were 20. So that just speaks to how like what could be happening there. And then definitely we've seen a lot of red flags in agriculture, in the agriculture industry. And those are very hard to investigate and prosecute because often it's a subcontractor that's actually the one exploiting. So the owner of the business might not be involved in it. And so it's very hard to get people to come forward and seek help. So I would say those are the two industries that I suspect there is a high prevalence of. The other ones I can't speak to as well.
Mm-hmm. And I would say also we talk a lot about immigration, but a lot of it is Americans. They're not immigrants. They could be runaways. They could be just people who are troubled at the time and they're recruited. So they can be local people who are trafficked also. So it's not just an immigration issue. It's very much the girls that I've personally worked with were all very local. They were from over in Fresno area. And so, yeah. Okay, thank you.
How many get investigated and or prosecuted in the county annually or however you want to count that?
Since 2000, probably 10 or right before that, maybe 2008, I think we've had like 9 cases come through because I was trying to dig back through history before our database and see how many were tagged as human trafficking. And my guess would be 8 or 9. We just recently had the one that pled, I can't remember the defendant's name, but he was a trafficker that came in. He had 3 victims here in the county. We got him separately, 2 and then 1, and helped them. And Central Coast Freedom Network came out and helped. But he pled to...
The 10 years?
I think it was 10. I think you're right. It was like 10 years. So we didn't have a trial, which is nice that he pled. But yeah.
So that's about 1 a year?
Something like that, yeah, because we just had one, yeah, 2018.
Do you think we're making a dent in it at that volume?
Not yet. Yeah. And often when I'm thinking about the process of it, I often equate it to domestic violence where it was 35, 40 years ago, where they were just starting with safe houses and laws were just starting. That's kind of where human trafficking is, where we're bringing awareness, we're starting the criminal cases, the laws are changing, we're doing education. So in 40 years, I think we'll be a lot farther. But right now, we're just fledgling, just starting it up. Yeah.
And I would like to go back to your question on prevalence. One thing that we've seen that is maybe a newer trend is, was it Cal Poly's police representative was on a panel back in April, and she spoke to the fact that traffickers are actually targeting Cal Poly students and finding their vulnerability being student loans or wanting to pursue education, and then finding them on sites like Sugar Daddies or, you know, webcam models, etc. There's a plethora of online sites where people who want to fund maybe their education, or it's a single, we've had it happen with single moms. They're in some kind of a financially vulnerable state, and then someone offers to treat them like an escort and then essentially recruits them into what turns into be sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how many different websites, but there's so many different ones. Yeah. Locally.
Well, and a lot of them are using like dating sites, Match.com, things like that. Traffickers have figured out a way how to use those sites that you could use, right? Anybody could use for non-trafficking reasons, but they're figuring out how to use them for trafficking victims. Yeah. So, yeah.
Say a little bit about the resources that the county is putting into this.
Yes, so that's a huge issue because resources are expensive, right? So right now, probably our biggest need, and I'm just going to start with the needs. Sorry, you meant the other direction, but I'm going to start with the needs. Our biggest need right now is housing. I think that's the hardest for us to find. Our local domestic violence shelter, RISE, will, if they have space in their safe house, will help us with a sex trafficking victim. But there's no housing for labor trafficking right now. We do absolutely have resources for children through CSECT, commercially sexually exploited children. And they have foster care that has trained foster parents? I guess foster parents that in trafficking. So if a child is trafficked, they go to child welfare services, just like any abused child would, and they get wraparound services. So anybody under the age of 18 gets housing, wraparound, through CWS, which is great, through child welfare services. But once you get over 18, that's when it becomes sketchy in our county. That's when it's harder for us to find resources. And like the women that I talked about earlier that we had in 2018 here, we had to call safe houses outside the area. We had to call Monterey and LA and around trying to find some place to have emergency housing. And that's one of the huge things that Central Coast Freedom Network and some other grassroots are working on, is getting that safe house going. We can get them counseling, and I know a couple grassroots places are coming up with grants for counseling, because that's very important. They do have case management. I'll let you speak to your resources that you do have.
Yeah. Well, first I'd like to give a shout out to Rise and Stand Strong, who do provide services when it intersects with domestic violence and sexual assault, which covers sex trafficking. We are basically a grassroots organization, and so we're completely privately funded. We have provided case management for 1 to 5 survivors at a time, and we've provided referrals and funding for counseling, legal support, etc., emergency financial assistance, scholarships, etc. And we have a network of people that will, you know, once a need arises, then we put the word out. And I think with that last case, within 24 hours, people donated $1,000 for like hotel room, bus ticket, clothing. Mm-hmm. However, there's a huge need when it comes to emergency assistance if more than one survivor was found, which is most likely what it's going to be. So we have been anticipating that need, and we desperately need assistance to come up with that solution. And I think that really before prosecution can happen, before investigation can happen, before reporting can happen, we have to build those resources. And we know that within the last few years there was a case that didn't get reported because those resources didn't exist, and that could have been up to 50 or more survivors. So we know that once we build it, we know that the need exists. We just need help building it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Central Coast Freedom Network is doing a great job trying to get those going. It's very hard to do the grassroots piece of that and get those built. So their resources, and Rise and Stand Strong are so good at that safe house, but they're impacted with their clients that are already coming to them. There's many times that they're full, and if we call them, there isn't a room, just because there isn't a room. We've already got them full with victims of domestic violence or sexual assault. So definitely a big need. I think that kind of answered it.
Well, I think there's another half or maybe another third of my question.
Okay.
And that's, this is obviously your position in the county government. This is your job. Are you doing it all by trying to do it all by yourself? Or, you know, what has the county committed to getting at this problem?
Well, and that's what the task force is. The task force is a bunch of county agencies, from public health to the district attorney to the sheriff's office, just a lot of them, bringing all of the people who are working on this problem together. We work with the Santa Barbara Task Force as well to kind of all come together and figure out, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to put these pieces together? So I'm not working by myself by any means. And I think part of it is we all have our own jobs, and we're doing human trafficking. So we're all just kind of putting it together. And there's no good answer for that yet, because we're all still trying to figure out where it is, what's going to be the best way to do this, and how can we best serve the victims, and how can we prevent the trafficking from happening, right? We don't just want to rescue the victim. We want to try to work towards preventing the trafficking in our society as well. That's way down the road. So, but we're keeping that in our brain. Did that answer it? Sort of. We don't really have, I don't know, I'm not sure. We don't have a county, this is our human trafficking department yet. We don't have that yet. We're starting with the task force. That's as close as we've gotten.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you both for your presentations. I just kind of had a comment that I used to see a lot of the teens, young, junior high, high school age teens coming through on magazine sales.
Mm-hmm.
My business, the nonprofit I worked with, was located in kind of a shopping center area, and they just come through and run through, and I'd go, where are you from? And they'd be from LA or all these places, and there'd just be a van full of these kids. They'd come through and drop them off, and they'd run through the business district, and away they went. Mm-hmm. And so thank you for this, because now I would try and get a license plate and call a APD.
Right.
And
yeah, that would be a
good, because I always felt that was just wrong. Mm. And I'm glad to see that Teen Challenge is no longer exploiting their residents, sticking them out clear over in our county, begging in front of all the grocery stores and things. And that wasn't right either. And I haven't seen them in a long time. I hope it was probably the stores that quit doing it. I don't know. But, you know, anytime you're taking advantage of someone in a vulnerable situation, whether they're children or somebody in early recovery, it's not right.
Mm-hmm.
So this brings me to my other question. When we're looking at the difference in cultures, because I ran into this when we were looking, I was on a group that was looking at teen pregnancies, and we got our numbers way down, and then all of a sudden our numbers went way back up. And there was a cultural difference. And because the age of consent in Mexico is much different than it is here. It isn't 18.
Yeah.
And whether, you know, it's like 15 and 16, and with parent consent, it's like 12 and 14.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see, because I live in an agricultural area, and you see very young men coming up here to work in these fields.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've probably got a girlfriend that's going to wind up here when she's 15.
Yeah.
And so how are we looking when you talk about prevention? The only one of the ways I see to look at that is maybe through the churches.
Yes.
And particularly the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And encouraging them to work with you on these issues and what's going on around that.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to speak to the churches?
I think that, yes, I think that the churches can be a solution. And I believe we are working with several local churches that are working on it in kind of more conspicuous underground ways, but I think that we welcome the opportunity to present to anyone and everyone and to collaborate. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we also have North County Abolitionists on the task force, and they are women from different churches and are planning on doing outreach to churches coming up. That's one of the things we're talking about.
And what about the, how are we addressing the cultural issue here?
The cultural issue is, that is huge. And we work a lot with the Latina services at Stand Strong. She's on our task force, Antonia Winters. So we get a lot of good feedback from her, from that community, and trying to understand and make sure we're not just plowing through of what's going through. We do have language barriers. Like, we had law enforcement calling, and they needed information in Vietnamese, and we didn't have it. We were trying, you know, we're scrambling for it. So a lot of it is trying to be culturally have that cultural humility and trying to create the spaces. But a lot of it is going to be trial and error as we try to go forward. But we're trying to bring on those partners that live in that culture that can advise us on that and that can kind of be the lead and the champion so that we don't step on toes. Do you have any?
I would say that I admire that question a lot, and I think that I have probably a lot to learn in that area, but it's something we value and would love to spend more time on and research on. Right now, I would say we're in like triage mode, so we're just trying to help people who come to us. When it comes to outreach, we would definitely do a lot more research on that and how to best do that. From my perspective right now, the best prevention would be providing resources so that we can offer an alternative when it comes to it.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for an eye-opening and sort of disturbing presentation. I really appreciate it. I wonder if you could talk about either educational kind of like trainings that you've done in the community. I know I've like read about flight attendants getting trainings on how to recognize trafficking. I wonder if you've done similar things in like the ER or with, or if you plan to do those kinds of things. Like what would be, like if you were going to do outreach to the county, where would you, what would you want to touch? Who would you want to give this information to? Because I feel like I'm just one person. So, yeah.
Well, Beth gives me a hard time because there's a list sitting in the task force of like 40 different agencies that we've identified that need training. And we've, you know, we've outlined the difference between preventative training and intervention training and then resource training. So we have a list. We are a small army. So we go where we're invited. Mm-hmm. We've presented to Cal Poly students, faith-based communities. We presented to a representative from the task force, myself presented to public nurses a couple years ago. It's really runs the gamut, and we cater our presentation accordingly. So a short answer would be everyone.
Everywhere.
Yeah. There's no place we won't go if invited. In some places, we're not invited. We call and, cold call and we'll ask. I would say for community education, if somebody who, either you or somebody who's watching this, Central Coast Freedom Network has a 40-hour training that they do for volunteers, if you want to plug that.
Yeah, thank you. Great. We did our pilot this last January and February, and we're offering it again in the fall. So the last two Saturdays in September, and then all of the Saturdays in October. It's 40 hours, survivor-informed. We learn from local experts like Beth, and we include training on labor trafficking as well. So it's a start. It's still not comprehensive enough, but it's a great start. And that will be open to the public, and then there will be discounted rates for people. It'll be free for people who are willing to volunteer with us and help us kind of create a solution.
And everybody can also keep their eyes out for different justice summits. We have a human trafficking summit happening in Morro Bay on September 15th. And you can Google that. I can't remember the actual website at the moment, but that's going to be really interesting. It's a full day training with lunch, and we're going to have a panel of experts and some speakers in education around human trafficking as well. So all these little things are popping up, and the district attorney puts them a lot on his social media, Facebook, and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, we're trying to get the word out.
And I would say if anybody wants an educational presentation specifically on sex trafficking in brothels and massage parlors, Freedom Calling is an organization in South County that kind of has spent a lot of diligent time learning the cultural components involved there and all of the different types of trafficking. So I'm sure that they would love to do a presentation on that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
I was just wondering, have you contacted Dignity Health? I mean, I work there, and they have community benefits, which is that community outreach piece, mm-hmm. and they have promotoras who are Spanish-speaking. Is that some place you've already contacted?
Yeah, they're on the task force, and they have, I will say, kudos to Dignity Health. They have a really good human trafficking plan, and actually they just sent me their sign that they're putting up in all their facilities that talks about human trafficking for all their people. They're also really good, I don't know your experience, but when I've gone about separating people, very like, oh, you don't know who I am, let's see what you do. And they did, they separated me, which I was really happy about. So, yeah, I do like Dignity Health, and they are on our board and very helpful, very wonderful. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Like everybody has said, we really do appreciate your time. A couple of questions. One, going back to sort of the training piece, where are you with training law enforcement? Seems to me like that would be an important one. If we're all being aware of these things that are happening mm-hmm. and occurring, and we are to call our local police department or sheriff in the county, what does that training look like, if at all? Mm-hmm. And two, do you have police or sheriff as part of the task force?
Yes, we certainly do. Those excellent question, because that is. That's where it starts. If somebody calls law enforcement, what are they going to do, right? So the Human Trafficking Task Force has some subcommittees, and one of the subcommittees is a law enforcement subcommittee. And our DA investigator, one of them heads it up. And so they have a meeting where they get together and talk about different situations. If there's a case arising, they talk about that case there. And they can kind of share resources and talk about training. So they're the ones kind of in charge of getting law enforcement on board, talking about training, and that sort of thing. One of the things we're trying to work on is something that law enforcement can have in their car, kind of like they do for sexual assault and domestic violence, so that they'll have something they can give a victim for their own education and for the education of anything they come across. But that's in process, like everything else around getting it out there and talking to them and bringing people on board. Yeah. And I forgot the second half of your question.
Do you have a police, a member of the local police force or sheriff on the task force?
Of course, I forgot because I answered it first, so I reversed it. Sorry.
One more question. It sounds like there's been a lot of very good work that's being done in terms of organizing and pulling resources and collaboration, and certainly the funding is a big piece to sort of taking that next step. Have you all sort of looked at some other models in other counties or other states around sort of this continued collaboration, like with family justice centers, with everyone being co-located in-house under one space, sharing, you know, all of that? I'm not sure if that's been given any thought, since there's so much similarity between these pieces with domestic violence, sexual assault, trafficking, even elder abuse, child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I would say yes. In my spare time, I've researched and looked at models and what is, you know, it varies county by county on what is successful. And at least in our limited perspective, a lot of the funding and grants we haven't qualified for because we had to reach that like 3-year mark, which now we have. So very interested in that conversation. I don't know that that's a conversation we've had at the task force level, but I believe that with all of our partners, we're constantly meeting, you know, for coffee and lunch, and like, how can we collaborate? We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We don't want to do it. So basically, we are constantly having that existential crisis of what part of us needs to exist and what part of us could be molded into something else, or what already does exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's a limited perspective, but
yeah. I think for our county too, we're very good at reaching out and trying not to duplicate services, because it's very confusing for victims as well when you duplicate services. Family justice centers have been a part of different conversations that I've heard, a lot of them around domestic violence. So I don't know that's a huge conversation. If we come up with like that centralized location, I think it's a good idea in some respects, but I also think there's safety issues with family justice centers when you're talking about trafficking and domestic violence specifically. So those are conversations that we would have to have with our grassroots partners and go, okay, what are the safety questions here? And we certainly wouldn't want to absorb all the funding into one spot and have outliers that didn't have any funding who still needed services. So I think those are big conversations, but we are desperately trying to collaborate and desperately trying to share services and get victims what they need. And if we can prosecute where we can. Yeah. So thank you.
Bob, did you have another question?
I have a whole list of them here.
Okay.
I have a two-part question. Where do you feel you need, pick one or two areas where you feel you need more, better, committed support from your county?
Okay.
And the second part of the question is, has our grand jury ever looked at this issue?
Okay. Well, to follow suit, I'm going to answer your second question first. I don't think they have. I've never seen anything from the grand jury on this, or I certainly haven't been to present there. I've only been part of this task force for, well, it was incepted in 2000, or it came to being in, what, 2014. And since that, I haven't heard anything from the grand jury. So that's a very good question. Grand jury would be interesting. From the county, I have to go back to the housing piece for adults. A lot of traffic victims, when they do escape, one that we worked with in partnership, she didn't have any connection. She'd been trafficked since she was 11 years old. She was 39 at her point of escape. That's a lot of long-term trauma. She had no family connection. She had no friends. She was a transient. But she walked out. She very bravely one day said, and walked out and just left. So I think working with housing, low-income housing, and in that realm, it's so hard here for housing for everybody. But housing, when you walk out of a trafficking situation, is so much harder. How do you even get there? Where do you take those steps? And what we did is we sent her to a shelter outside the county, is what we did. So I would say working with the housing and getting accessible housing for people in this county would be of vital importance. For a second one, can you think of a second one right now? I'm so stuck on housing.
Housing's it, and I guess I would say county-specific solutions. So maybe smaller grants, recognition as a service provider, just those creative solutions. Everyone that we've worked with that needs housing in a different way. Some people need help staying housed. Some people need help actually getting the housing. Sometimes we have funds for a hotel stay, but people have been exploited in hotels for a decade, so they need to stay somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So I would say small, localized, flexible grants.
Oh, that's a good answer, because then we can really localize it to labor, which we don't see a lot of mm-hmm. funding for, or sex trafficking. And really, around the hotels, she's so right when she says they've been exploited in hotels. But that, a lot of times, is our only option, mm-hmm. is to put them in a hotel. And so talk about needing to be culturally sensitive around their trauma. So, yeah, the creative grants and housing would be the answer, I think. Yeah. Good question. You're really making me think about it.
You've made us think, too. You know, based on some very, very peripheral experience and contacts with the grand jury, based on these minimal contacts, it's really impressive how earnest they are. And they love to dig. And they might be a good source to advocate for you at the higher levels of government.
So I think with the grand jury, somebody needs to bring, the grand jury looks at their cases or things that are brought to them. So it doesn't appear anybody has ever brought that up to them.
Yeah, how does that, I don't even know how that works to take it to them. I don't know the mechanism.
I'll ask.
Oh, okay, thank you, Mary Jane.
Ken's been on the grand jury. Great. I'll find out and email you.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you both for coming. We hopefully are going to be more active on your task force.
Yes.
Bob is one of our representatives, and Tamar is one of our representatives. So they will spend their time between the domestic violence and the human trafficking.
Great.
So they can hopefully keep us informed and up to date with what you guys are doing. And as this whole issue evolves and sounds like it might be getting bigger, so we want to stay on top of it. And as you say with your education, try to prevent it. Not only help those who go through it, but let's try to have some prevention in place. And hopefully, I think for the community as a whole, it's really hard for them to recognize or to realize, perhaps, that they might be seeing something. Where do you report it? So, in our cell phones, put that Polaris phone number there, right, or whatever. So good. Thank you both for coming this evening.
Okay. Thank you. And I will leave these brochures here with Jean. Okay. So,
Will you give Jean the PowerPoint so she can email it out to us also?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Dr. Bornstein, do you want to report on some things from public health?
Just a few things that have been going on in my world. Swine flu, or the cases of human flu contracted from pigs at the Mid-State Fair. I bring that up again, not to, you know, beat it to death. I got some feedback on that, you know, so what's the importance? And I thought I would take this opportunity to talk about why that became a news story. Because in many ways, it's not much of a story. A bunch of people got the flu, many of them children, and that happens every year. Nobody got particularly sick or died or... But the reason it's a very big deal in the public health world is because our pandemics tend to come from animals. And so what happens is you get a mixture of humans and animals. Often it's pigs, sometimes other mammals, but and birds. And the influenza virus is very good at reinventing itself by creating small, and then sometimes small on top of small creates large, or just a large genetic mutation in the virus. And so first what you have to have is a new virus that's new to human beings, and then the ability for it to become easily spread from human to human. So this was sort of the first step, and that where we saw transmission from an animal, in this case pigs, to humans. And so the importance of it is for everybody to get the genetic typing, everybody being the scientists at CDC and the state, and to know exactly what we're dealing with. Is this a different strain? It was H1N2, and that has been seen in only a handful of cases previously. But also we did, though not at the time that we put out our press releases, we didn't have evidence. We still don't have any absolute clear evidence, but it does seem like there might have been some limited person-to-person transmission. And so it's just important for the public health surveillance system to really keep an eye on this. It's also a really good opportunity to remind people that this is from whence killer flu viruses can come, and therefore it's a good idea to use all the precautions that we recommend with respect to handling animals and sleeping with animals and eating with animals and hand washing after you've done so, etc. So I just wanted to put that story in context of a larger public health perspective.
Do you ever do any education with the 4-H clubs about that?
What was the question?
Have you ever done any education toward the 4-H
clubs? Yes, we have, and this is another opportunity. 4-H was very cooperative with us, and FFA, and definitely. There's a brand new, just came out the week that we... last week, a brand new document that's a comic book version of a book aimed at kids for how to prevent disease in handling of animals. So they're going to hopefully take that on to, you know, distribute to their minions, etc. So that is swine flu. A couple of other reminders of things that are in our midst. We did have a rabid bat. We do occasionally have those in our county. We had one that tested positive that was handled by a family of four because it seemed everyone wanted to see the bat, and it was cute, and it wasn't quite dead yet. And so, once again, I want to use this as an opportunity to remind the viewing public that handling bats at all, especially if it's not part of a research study, but certainly a bat that is sick and dying, is probably not the best approach. So a number of people are now getting their prophylactic, their immunizations for having, you know, said, well, what do you think? So, just as a reminder that we do have rabies in bats in our county, and when a bat is flailing around on the ground, it's either best to call animal control. Pacific Wildcare also will pick up bats. And if there is going to be any handling of bats, not with hands that are not gloved, but I don't recommend it at all. The third disease that I wanted to make mention of, because the state is coming out with a new report for the 2017 Valley Fever numbers, otherwise known as coccidioidomycosis. This is a fungal disease that is not spread person to person, but does tend to become more prevalent in years after, when we have some rain after drought periods. This year didn't exactly qualify as that. We did have some of a wet early year last year, we just saw numbers off the charts. And so we're the third highest county in the state in terms of our Valley Fever rate. We're also the third highest county in terms of the actual numbers of cases. So 2017, we had 283 cases and a rate of 150 per 100,000 population. The state average went from a rate of 6 per 100,000 population in 2014 to almost 19 in 2017. So put in context, 19 being the state average, 150 in this county, nearly 300 cases. We were third only to Kings and Kern County, which have always been the epicenter for Valley Fever. So we've got an issue in this county, and again, it's an opportunity for folks to be aware that if they have been in areas where ground has been churned up, or even gardening in a spot in your home garden that hasn't been utilized in a long time, that any kind of aerosolized dust particles from areas that have not seen the light of day for a while are great reservoirs for the Valley Fever fungus. And we are heading into a year, 2018, where in the first half of the year we had almost as many cases as 2017. So it's not letting up yet. And then the last thing I wanted to mention, this is, we've been starting to get inquiries from media, and it's something we've been aware of, and just to let you know, there are these periodic drug shortages of varying types, sometimes for infectious diseases, sometimes for other conditions. We're now experiencing, and it's important in our EMS industry, in the emergency medical services response teams, that they are being really spread thin on medications like morphine for pain. So we have a lot of trauma and injuries in our county, and we are running low on morphine. And the other drug that we're seeing shortages on is dopamine, which is a trying to keep blood pressure up when you've got bleeding problems or other things that might be causing a rapid drop in blood pressure. And so the EMS system is looking at alternatives and just staying, you know, tuned into this. But this is a national problem where our pharmacists, system tends to go through these cycles that we're not quite sure what causes them, but we always like to make sure that folks are aware. And that's my report. Thanks.
Any questions for Dr. Bornstein?
Yes, I have a thank you, Penny. I have a question on for the Valley Fever. When you said we're expecting more, are the physicians better at asking patients about their exposure?
We did a bit of a provider and public education campaign last year. I think we need to do more of it. I still become aware all the time of people, of the providers putting on their diagnostic list that maybe this is TB, more likely it's community acquired pneumonia. In a time and place where we are, COXI should absolutely be on the list. And so we are always trying to get that information out in various ways. I'm planning a meeting with the ER doctor soon, and that's one of the items on our list is, you know, anytime you're thinking this might be a bacterial pneumonia, think COXI. So.
And how easy is it to test for it?
Not so easy, but... The problem is sometimes early testing will miss it, much like Lyme disease. And so sometimes you have to go back. But we have a good referral mechanism from our lab, and Sierra Vista also has using UC Davis for testing for COXI. It's not that difficult to pick it up. Sometimes you might have to do it a second time a little further down in the course of disease.
So is there any thought as to why we are so high?
No, not really. Mm. I mean, if you look at maps of where Valley yeah. fever resides, it's a fairly narrow geographic area in the world. It's, you know, parts of California, Arizona, into mm-hmm. Mexico, a little bit into Nevada, Utah. I think it just... has really taken hold in the soils here, and then you get these cycles of wet followed by dry followed by wet, and that stirs things up. Maybe we have a lot of construction going on.
I was going to say, if we have more all the new yeah. construction and everything, mm-hmm. I mean, that's possible.
Yeah. So much to the point that some, like our certain prisons were deemed endemic, and so folks who are at higher risk for disseminated and worse outcomes from disease were transferred to other prisons. So CMC is one such designated prison where we now no longer are supposed to house HIV inmates. But yeah, I don't know why. Kern County, I don't know that they know why they are the highest endemic the county in the
seem more
the state.
Desolate than we are. I mean, yeah. that's
more rural. More,
yeah.
yeah,
more rural.
We have
the right climate, and yeah. the soil hasn't been disturbed probably yeah. for a yeah. long time. Yeah. But now they're deep tilling for grapes.
Yep, vineyards, other kinds of ag. We're mm-hmm. really housing in mm-hmm. all ways. We're digging up our soil. Why more so here than other places? Yeah. I'm not sure, but
good.
Yeah.
Quick question, just of any of those cases, are any children?
Of Valley fever?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah. it's still going to be heavy on the adults, though, less yeah. on the kids mm-hmm. for obvious reasons.
Yeah. Tends to be more common in men. There's also an ascertainment bias because we're more likely to identify those who get sick. And... So in places where you have, you know, occupational reporting or, you know, pregnant women, African-Americans, Filipinos are, for reasons unclear, tend to get sick. So we do see more of those cases. Amongst everyone who becomes infected, only 40% will have any kind of illness. And for the majority of them, it's a flu-like illness that they may not see their physician or get tested, but you know, another 5% will go on to have very significant disease.
All right, let's move on to our own commissioner reports. Tamara, let's start down with you.
No reports, no updates.
I attended the Adult Services Policy Council meeting, and the great presentations. One of them was on creative mediation. I myself did not realize what things they did for our community, a wonderful resource, and she gave a great presentation. That's something we might want to consider at some point in time. The other presentation was from People Self-Help Housing. She was also giving a report on all the different housing options that are available. And the one thing that's really nice about People Self-Help Housing is that they really do. I mean, they gave the presentation when I
was attending the one for older adults, which is nice because there's specific housing for older adults. But there are many things that are available. And the one thing that's wonderful is that they have social work support. So these people not only are getting housing, but they're getting, you know, resources in the community. And there was also a presentation from the Area Agency on Aging. They gave a Joyce Allen was talking about she would like to give a presentation about the needs assessment for older adults. And so that's something they just recently did. And that's another thing we might want to consider looking at in the future.
Nothing from me.
Susan? Yes, the Homeless Services Oversight Council is very active right now because the state has announced that it's got some surplus funding that they're putting in pots to go out to the counties to create some additional housing, very low income and that. So what's happening is on Tuesday the 21st, the whole Board of Supes meeting that day is going to be looking at all types of housing and housing needs in the county. I would invite everybody to come here and be a part of that discussion. And if they can't, they can sit at home and watch it on Charter Channel 21. And or watch it later on because I think it's going to be, it sounds like it's going to be a really good overview of looking at it from a lot of different perspectives. And because they also, this fall, we're going to have to put together, update our housing plan, the next 10-year plan for housing for the county. So we have to do that by the end of the year. So I think this is that opportunity for the community and the supervisors and everybody to come together and find out just all the different options and maybe some that we haven't thought of. So if you've got suggestions, come and bring them that day. And it's going to be an exciting fall.
Going back to air pollution, there's been nothing reported yet on progress in implementing the agreement between the state and the county regarding Oceano Dunes. There is a deadline coming up in September, and that will be hopefully reported on at the APCD board meeting late September. So we won't be able to hear about it for a couple months. And I think that might be an interesting indicator to see how the whole process might go. There are enough said about that. There are also, if anyone's interested, there are four openings for members and alternate members on the APCD hearing board. The board does not do a whole lot. They usually don't get involved, but when there's an issue that needs adjudication, they do get involved, such as in the recent Oceano Dunes stuff. So they're looking for an active attorney, an alternative attorney, and then two, an alternate for the attorney position, and then two community members also as alternates, perhaps to move into regular spots over the next few years. Having just sat through many days of that, it's an interesting process, and it needs it needs people who think critically.
And the hearing board is separate from the other board, right?
Yes, it's entirely separate, except that the hearing board members are appointed by the Air Pollution Control District Board. So they're not entirely autonomous. And after this last hearing, there was a motion from one of the supervisors to make sure that the individual supervisors got more involved in choosing and vetting the candidates?
Okay. I have a couple of things. I gave everyone a flyer for the upcoming Health and Housing Summit that the Healthy Communities Work Group is co-sponsoring with a number of other organizations. It is Thursday, October the 4th. It's a full afternoon from 1 to 6. It will be at the Vets Hall. It is a free event, but we do ask you to register. And on the back of the flyer, I believe there's the website where you can register on that. So we, too, will be talking about housing. Our keynote speaker is a young woman from this organization called Change Lab. Went right out of my head there. Change Lab Solutions. I think she's actually quite a dynamic speaker. I'm anxious to hear her. I've seen some webcast things that she has done. We do have a fairly large panel that we've assembled to talk about what's happening locally here in San Luis County and how we can connect health and housing together. People Self-Help will be there. And Wyatt from HomeShare will be there. SlowCog has someone coming to talk about some of our regional housing needs. Someone from the Builders Association will also be on that panel, as well as the Community Development Director for the City of San Luis Obispo. So you are all welcome to attend. It should be a very full afternoon. We've also developed a piece on health and housing that talks about some of the concerns as well as some of the needs, and I will they've just come up with the final draft, or not the draft, the final piece of that. I will you have them available for you next month, or I can email, we'll have Jean email that out to all of you in the meantime. The Oral Health Coalition will actually be meeting tomorrow. We're going to meet down at CHC in Santa Maria, actually, because we're about to put together the first virtual or dental home for dental patients. So we're meeting to see the mobile unit that they'll be using. The organization up in Paso del Tolosa, they are now doing a program with the University of Pacific to do that also. So we actually should have two in the county, one out at Chandon, and I have forgotten where the other one is. But I will go to the meeting tomorrow and bring back whatever information we have from there. And with that, I think that's all that I have. How about our own committee reports? I'm sure nominating has something to report.
Actually, I have two things to report. I was going to make mention about the legislative committee. I actually sit on the American Nurses Association for California's legislative committee. There's some very interesting things that have kind of come across some of the bills in Sacramento about housing and how, you know, we as health hospitals identified as a place for housing them, and we're already impacted. So there's a lot of things that are being discussed, but one of my members, co-members, was talking about a place, and I had never heard of it, in L.A. County, San Pedro. It's called the Harbor House Facility. Are you familiar with that, anybody? But what's really nice is it's an old brownstone high school that's been refurbished. Things that we, you know, you can retrofit to make sure that we have housing. Some of these buildings that we may have but aren't being utilized, you know, a high school has all the elements that you would possibly need, or an old high school, like showers and dining rooms, three meals a day. Those are the kinds of things. So it's nice to see that
other organizations are looking at that at a state level, and we need to be mindful legislatively, no matter where we are within our own jobs and, you know, as a part of the legislative committee for a nursing organization. So that's for legislative. Nominating, our nominating committee will be meeting at the end of this month. We have five candidates that have sent in applications. We are going to be filling two consumer, one direct. So we'll be meeting and selecting those kinds of, you know, looking and seeing what we have available and hopefully filling the positions.
So maybe in October you'll bring us some recommendations.
Right? Correct.
Good, good. All right, prospective future items. One of the things we need to talk about a little bit tonight is our November meeting. There's a Monday holiday in November, which is when we, the second Monday, which is when we would ordinarily meet. So we have a choice. We can bump it down to the next Monday, which is the Monday, it's the week of Thanksgiving. I don't know if that's an issue or a problem for anyone. If we go any later than that, then we're really into our December meeting. If we go earlier than the second one, then we're into our, we're right on the heels of our October meeting, because isn't October is a Monday holiday too, so we're coming late. So what, yes, I'm aware of that. So what's your pleasure? Do we could go dark that month. We remember we decided to go dark in February because there's two Monday holidays, and we ordinarily, very often we do that. We could go dark one more month. We need to have 10 meetings a year. So is the Monday of Thanksgiving an issue for anybody?
Well, the ones that...
Okay, so if it's not an issue for everybody, then can you try to get the chamber, Jean, and we'll just bump it down to that week, a week later?
I already have the chamber's reserved.
Okay, so... Okay. All right, so we'll be... so our November meeting will be the 3rd, the 19th.
That's what we decided. That's what's listed there.
Okay. But we didn't know if schools are closed or families or whatever. Okay. All right. Anybody have anything else before we adjourn for this evening? Next month, our topic is the new face of tobacco. And I believe Dr. McLaren will be here to talk a little bit about her new role out at the county jail. Jean?
One last comment today. When I was on vacation up in Canada, I found a newspaper article that was very interesting. Here it is, a big article talking about questions about cannabis. We have the answers. So it's nice to see a newspaper that's actually asking the questions that we all should be asking, and if we at some point can sit as a group, how do you buy cannabis, all the way down to is it addictive, stocks, and all these important questions that we as healthcare providers and on Health Commission should be supportive of some way of making sure that this information gets out to the community. So I don't know whether it's something we need to put in the forefront. We had talked about what's happening with, you know, the cannabis issue here in our county, but we also need to make sure that there's those health issues are addressed as well.
Thanks for bringing that for us. You have your eyes open all the time, Jean. That's why we love you. So, okay. All right. If there's nothing else, we will be adjourned for this evening. Thank you all.